Ladies and gentlemen, people of the internet, welcome back to yet another episode of Crypto Over Coffee. I hope you're doing well today. And if you're new here, every Saturday, we start off the weekend right by breaking down the latest news and the hottest topics in the world of technology and cryptocurrency over a cup of delicious coffee. And today we have the cold brew edition. That being said, in today's episode, I'm talking about the Bitcoin and crypto sell-off we've seen in the past couple days, plus some huge news about Cardano and Elrond, our usual 404 Logic Not Found segment, and more. So make sure you stick around for the whole episode so you get all the updates. And as we always do, let's kick off the episode with questions from you, the awesome folks who watch my channel and listen to the podcast. If you want one of your questions answered in next week's episode, leave them in the comments below, tweet me at Hashoshi4, or leave them in the Hashoshi Discord, which I will leave a link to in the show notes. If you would be so inclined, please do also subscribe to the channel, follow the podcast, and hit the notification button wherever you are so you get a heads up whenever I post future episodes of Crypto Over Coffee and more. So thanks so much, and let's dive into this first question. Now, the first question is from Taz Zink. Recently, I've encountered people dissing Cardano because Charles Hoskinson, the founder of Cardano, left Ethereum because he wanted to go corporate. They say that means ADA, the cryptocurrency that's native to Cardano, will never be as decentralized as ETH because its connection to IOHK, the company who runs a lot of the development efforts for Cardano. I've seen also people saying that Cardano will be fully decentralized in the future, implying some sort of unleashing from IOHK. Can you explain what these things mean, if anything? Now, this question I want to start with sort of at a high level, and this sort of harkens back to an argument that I've made on past episodes, and that is, if 100% decentralization is the only goal and the only measure of success, there is not one cryptocurrency project that has, and or in my opinion, will ever achieve that goal. Human beings by default, by nature, always are prone to centralization, even in small, subtle ways. Building an open source community around a project to help build community governance proposals. That's a form of centralization. It maybe is like 0.5%, so you're 99.5% decentralized now, but that's not a problem. That's okay. And so just because you have a foundation that does a lot of the building of the network and growing it, doesn't mean that it's garbage, right? So the Ethereum Foundation does a lot of work on Ethereum and its ecosystem, and that's okay. IOHK has taken the same path for building Cardano, and that's also okay. Have they run nodes? Have they run potentially important parts of the service and mainnet? Absolutely. But the plan is for that not to happen long term. And I think that their plan is adequate in that regard to give guidance and to give control to the community. And they've already done that in a large part. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. And the constant argument between Cardano and Ethereum versus Polkadot and all this stuff, it's counterproductive. These networks need to work together, not fight each other for the same market share. New users need to come in or crypto won't succeed. So that should be the focus, not tearing each other down. But if we're talking about, will Cardano be fully decentralized? Again, I don't think it will ever be 100% decentralized, nor really should it, or nor does it need to be successful. So just bear that in mind. The things that have been done with Shelley bringing proof of stake and staking and incentives, bringing stake pools into the mix to let the community make blocks. That was the first roadblock. Now community governance with Voltaire, a future development update that's in the works. That's going to be really important. So I think people just really need to be patient with this type of thing because we're changing paradigms here and it's going to take time to really fully understand how these things will work in the future. So thanks so much for your question. Next question is from King Lalibela. Hashoshi, hope you and your missus are well. Thank you very much. We are. It's great to watch your channel. Thanks so much. If you were sitting on a bag of Tezos, would you keep them or trade them for what you believe to be something better? So I tend to not comment too much on, you know, what should you trade? What should you buy? So this is not about that. And this is not a financial advice or a piece of advice. But just recently, I'll give you an example of what I did. I had some Tezos. And I was baking that Tezos, so staking it essentially on the network. And I noticed that there were other projects that I wanted to invest in, but because of my own, you know, principles in terms of how much money I want to risk, I decided I'm going to move money from crypto I have into other crypto. So I moved half of my Tezos into something else. What that something else is really irrelevant to this question, but I did move half my Tezos out into a different cryptocurrency. So I think it's a totally fair move. But that's not to say that Tezos does not have any potential. To me, personally, it's been a little too quiet for my personal taste, and I still have, you know, admiration for some of the things that the project has done and some of the achievements that have been made. But for me personally, I was not too worried about selling out half of my Tezos. And that's just my personal opinion. So hopefully this helps you, King Lalabella, and anyone who might be thinking about it. But I'm but one example. Take it with a grain of salt. Thank you. Third question is from Taj Street. Thanks for the great content. Is Polygon, which is now the rebrand of Matic, classified as an L2 or a sidechain? And what are the advantages and disadvantages of each? So Polygon is technically a layer two solution. And the difference between a layer two and a sidechain is fairly nuanced. Basically, a layer two sits on top of a layer one chain. So a layer one chain is like the Ethereum mainnet, the Cardano mainnet, the Elrond mainnet. And a layer two sits on top of that, and it derives its security from that layer one mainnet's consensus process and finality. So in essence, you can think of a layer two as something that it's an extension, a scalable extension for transaction throughput expansion on top of the security of the layer one blockchain protocol to which it belongs. So Matic has long been that. A sidechain is something that's slightly different because it makes its own sort of security mechanism, and it has its own completely separate security process. And therefore, if your sidechain itself gets hacked or overwhelmed in, say, a 51% attack, you could lose funds. Whereas if you have that same sort of construct occur in a layer two, there are means by which you could recover funds. And there's been a lot of discussion about this online and a lot of, you know, theoretical discussion about how these things should be defined. The problem is, in the community and even from projects, these terms get used interchangeably, and so it gets very confusing. But that's generally, at a high level, how people like to think about the difference between the two. One is very much a standalone network that sort of sits next to a blockchain protocol, and then the other, which would be your layer two protocols, sit on top of that layer one chain, and that's why they're called layer twos. So hopefully that explains it a little bit better. But Polygon is sort of towing the line and blending and blurring that line between an L2 and a sidechain, having, you know, in many ways, its own security guarantees in a way, but still being very reliant on finality of the Ethereum mainnet up till now. But with their new strategy and their new rebrand, starting to bridge between Polkadot and others, and to bring in different optimistic rollups and different ZK rollup technologies to, you know, further scale their network, I think the line is going to continue to get blurred. So I know that that's not a totally concrete answer like you might have wanted, but hopefully that clears it up a little bit. Thanks for your question. Now, the last question of the day is from Zach Adkins. I am a soon-to-be computational mathematics bachelor's of science graduate. Congratulations on that. Do you have any specific skill suggestions for me to develop if I'm interested in becoming a developer in the crypto space? My recommendation to you would be to study up on the fundamentals of cryptography, which you will likely be very, very comfortable with and at home with. You might even have some fundamentals already down, but I think you want to look at the application of cryptography in the context of blockchains. There are some fantastic resources out there for this. If you want more specific ones, please feel free to send me an email that is on my my channel page. But what I would recommend to you is to start with the cryptography foundations, and then I would start to pick up a fundamental programming language, something like JavaScript or Python, because then you will be able to use that to bridge to other languages. Some people like to start with C++. I'm personally not a massive fan of C++, but that's all personal preference. Pick one of those fundamental languages and run with it, keep learning and growing. And from there, I think you'll find with cryptography skills and base level programming skills, you have the tools that you need to learn basically anything in the blockchain space. And over time, you'll pick up the understanding of how to build and architect and design major decentralized applications and even protocols in some cases. So hopefully that gives you a good idea, but you can also study economics. It's a very, 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 very valuable study in this space. So thanks so much for the questions, you guys. Let's get into the news. Now, just a friendly reminder, please be aware of scammers that are in the comments that are posing as me. They're often saying, contact me on WhatsApp or talk to my manager or my administrator. I don't have any of those things and I will never reach out to you. So if the comment does not have the name highlighted like you see here, it's not me. You can report them, ignore them, or comment and let me know and I'll delete them. Also, for those of you who are new here, every week in partnership with the folks at Kobo who make the awesome Kobo Vault wallet, I'll be giving away a Kobo tablet steel seed phrase backup device in every episode of Crypto Over Coffee from here on out. So all you have to do to enter the random draw every week is to comment on the video and I'll pick a random winner from the comments. And just for transparency, the product is only available in select regions. So make sure that if you are in an unsupported region, and I'll let you know if that's the case, I'm just going to send you Bitcoin instead. Now, the winner of last week's giveaway for the Kobo is here on the screen. You see the random draw for transparency. So big congratulations to you. And of course, I will be in touch to get you your prize. Now, in keeping with the Crypto Over Coffee tradition, let's start with a Bitcoin price analysis sesh and discuss this Bitcoin dip, which has dragged a lot of the crypto markets down. And of course, based on the volatility of the market, it may end up being outdated by the time this video launches, such is life. Now, at this moment in time, while I'm recording this video, Bitcoin has recovered from, or I guess recovered somewhat, from an overnight low of 44,000 in some markets. And it's now sitting around the $47,000, $48,000 US mark, which represents the second or third period of consolidation that we've seen in the crypto markets since the big push up towards $60,000 US not too long ago. We never hit that mark, but we got close. And this is about the time that people start to worry or panic, especially fickle retail investors who got in at the top thinking this was a get-rich-quick scheme. Now, the sell-offs usually begin to compound when a big dip in price occurs below psychological levels, which are often multiples of 10. In other words, when people see Bitcoin's price drop below 50,000 into the 40s, that tends to affect people more than maybe a larger cumulative drop from 58 to 50 that doesn't cross a psychological threshold. People are weird. However, what I'm sure everyone is wondering now is whether this signals the end of the bullish cycle that we've been talking about for months now. And in my humble opinion, the answer is markedly no. We may see more drops in price that will hurt in the short term, maybe even below 40K, but I don't think that we've seen the end of the bullish cycle yet. In fact, I don't think we've even begun the true bull run, as some may want to call it. And the widespread demand for Bitcoin is only going to continue to grow from here, in my humble opinion. Based on what I can see, miners are not selling Bitcoin in hyper-massive quantities, institutional demand is not waning significantly, and when whales sell, they are usually selling at rallies and then they're buying back in when the price dips. So this implies to the casual observer that whales are accumulating, not necessarily leaving the market, which is a really good sign. So from my perspective, I've been around for all the major bull markets in Bitcoin's history, most notably the ones in 2013 when people were like, whoa, this actually is worth something. Then in 2017 where people were like, whoa, this is worth a little too much. And you saw the most white hot fear of missing out across retail and big money investors back then in 2017, where millions of dollars were going in terms of fiat currency at what seemed like hourly rates, like people were buying like crazy. And I have to credit this analysis point to WhaleMap, an on-chain analytics site, because they noticed this trend. You can see the trend on their site about, you know, the millions that were flowing in 2017, that we haven't seen that type of FOMO quite yet in 2021. And I think the majority of the moves to new all-time highs that we've seen to date in 2021 are on the back of institutions buying up more than the Bitcoin supply inflation can provide in terms of Bitcoin on the open market. Simply, demand is outstripping supply. So what may bring the true vicious move upward will be that retail and whale FOMO that we saw in 2017. Maybe that happens, or maybe we see a gradual ride upwards on the back of more healthy institutional investment. Now, it's impossible, totally impossible to predict what's actually going to happen, but there are some of the paths that you can see, forks in the road that you could see play out. But I'm going to turn the question to you. What do you think we'll see for the duration of 2021 for Bitcoin? Let me know what trends you're looking at and drop me a comment below. Now, for Cardano fans, the news has been pretty awesome across the board, with the native ADA cryptocurrency running well over the $1 mark, breaking into the top three cryptocurrencies by market capitalization, and a plethora of new updates coming into mainnet. In fact, Cardano's ADA has been one of the major coins that has remained largely in the green when other cryptocurrencies have been downtrending in price. Now, people are asking me, hey, why is ADA not going down while Bitcoin is going down? This is most likely due to the confirmed launch of the Mary update, named after Mary Shelley, that will come on Monday, March 1st. And this update is going to bring native multi-asset support to the Cardano mainnet so that users can create, manage, and transact their own custom tokens without the need to create a smart contract to do so. This means that the Cardano blockchain's core ledger is going to manage these user-created tokens, and fees will be paid in ADA along the way, presenting an alternative to the usual means by which tokenization has been facilitated on blockchains like Ethereum, which have long been the king of tokenization, if you will. What makes this feature particularly unique, though, is that Cardano's extended unspent transaction output model, otherwise known as the EUTXO, is capable of transferring multiple tokens in one output, making the transfer of many different tokens possible in a batch format natively. And this helps maintain scalability long-term for token ecosystems and economies, so I can't wait to test this out and see how it works in mainnet. And this is just the first of many exciting updates to come for Cardano in 2021. And of course, it opens up the door to all types of use cases on the network as smart contracts come to full effect in the second quarter of 2021. So the future is very bright for Cardano, in my opinion, and the patience that's been shown from the supporters for the longest time is now being rewarded as the white paper and the bold claims for the long time are now coming to fruition. Now, another layer one protocol or project in the blockchain space that I'm a big fan of is Elrond. And they just announced that the native eGold cryptocurrency is going to be accepted at over 30,000 merchants as a payment method by way of the Romanian payments company Netopia. Now, this basically means that starting on March 1st, eGold holders are going to be able to pay merchants through Netopia directly from eGold to fiat currency with minimal friction. So payments will first be available via e-commerce, but it will expand in the future to more avenues for payment. And to me, this news is extremely positive because it gives eGold the opportunity to be used for one of the big use cases that it was touted for in the very beginning, and that is scalable payments with minimal fees. So I can see the expansion of user-created smart contracts and tokens in the future as this comes to, you know, fruition on the Elrond network being supported as payments and integrated into the external e-commerce world as time goes on, sort of bridging that gap between the traditional internet marketplaces and cryptocurrency projects. And this will only make Elrond that much more useful for its users, which of course is the primary reason these protocols exist, to create really, really great experiences for its users. In other news, in this week's episode, I'm partnering with Icon Plus, a public representative in the Icon ecosystem, to bring you more content about Icon and the happenings on the network. Now, today I want to share with you the advent of DeFi on the Icon blockchain in the form of a project called Balanced DAO. Name is really cool, by the way. Balanced DAO is tackling one of the major pillars of decentralized finance, which is to provide collateralized assets and stablecoins to give users less volatile means of payment and to enable the creation of other DeFi projects and service offerings like lending, savings, and more within the context of Icon and beyond. Without adequate stablecoin options or collateralized asset options, most DeFi ecosystems in general cannot be built. So Balanced DAO will first allow owners of the native cryptocurrency on Icon called ICX to deposit their ICX holdings in exchange for a USD-pegged stablecoin asset so they can make payments in a stable denomination, buy other cryptocurrencies, or get exposure to DeFi on Ethereum without exiting ICX in general. The possibilities for this are very, very broad, pretty much endless. So for ICX holders who are actively delegating on a self-custody wallet, meaning they own their own private keys, Balanced DAO will begin airdripping, yes, it's not a mistake, balanced tokens based on the volume of ICX one is delegating in their app. So this presents an opportunity for those contributing to the Icon ecosystem by delegating their ICX to claim balanced tokens on a weekly basis after launch. So if you're currently holding ICX and you're delegating in a self-custody wallet, keep your eyes out for instructions on how to claim your weekly drip of balanced tokens in this sort of slow drip of tokens to people when the project launches in the coming weeks. And I'll link something up down below to show you where you can learn more about Balanced DAO. So thanks so much. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it is time for 404 Logic Not Found. And for those of you who are as of yet uninitiated in this little firecracker of a segment, I highlight notable tech-related fails or otherwise stupid moves or stupid thoughts in the world that need to get some attention. And speaking of attention, if you want to help this video or this podcast get attention from the algorithm robots, hit that like button, get subscribed, hit the follow button, because it tells the robots that run this whole content show that you're enjoying it and other people might do the same. So thank you so much for that in advance. So since the dawn of CryptoKitties, I've had people from all walks of life who love to debate me on the merits of non-fungible tokens and digital collectibles or items. So often, I find myself arguing against the primal tendency for human beings to only value things that are tangible, shiny, and if we're being honest, often made in China. The core human aversion to valuing digital items in the same way that they do physical ones has caused a series of fiery debates about whether NFTs are worthless bits and bytes on a computer screen or in fact truly valuable assets that one can own. So I spoke with my good friend Steve McGarry, who runs the Hack Crypto YouTube channel, about this topic. So I'm gonna play that video for you here on this topic. Have a listen.
NFTs have kind of fulfilled what, certain parts of what Bitcoin was originally trying to do in certain elements of crypto with ownership and, transacting and things like that. So let's talk a little bit about NFTs and in terms of like how you see that in terms of this stage.
Yeah, I think NFTs have evolved a lot since the earliest popular form of it, which was CryptoKitties and then, CryptoPunks. And I laugh about it still because I think one of the first videos I ever made was like, I made this like really random, like sort of FOMO video about CryptoPunks. And it was like, at the time I'm like, wow, this is embarrassing. Like no one cares about this. And now looking back, like there are CryptoPunks selling for insane sums of money. So I'm like, hey, hopefully somebody made some money from that video. But NFTs, the technology behind them have changed a ton. And there are other chains outside of Ethereum that are doing a great job at getting non-fungible tokens into the mainstream. Like I know there's examples of, in the Icon ecosystem, Phantasma is one that's like really got a good foothold in the NFT space with their ghost market and et cetera. And so I'm really excited for what's to come there because you can use non-fungible tokens for so many different things. It's not just digital art. It's not just digital collectibles, but it's, event tickets. It's, there are some people that are making standards that are non-fungible in regards to, titles to homes and cars and other big fixed assets. I mean, that the potential is fairly endless for non-fungibles. But that being said, I think the biggest challenge is a generational gap and a generational concern with, a large set of people in the world right now, not able to reconcile the fact that they own something that doesn't have a physical form in the truly digital, digital art, digital collectibles. So I'd flip a question to you then. What do you think the panacea is to the poison in regards to that challenge? Like, how do you communicate the value proposition of something that doesn't have a physical form?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. And my mom actually is a visual artist. She's been a visual artist all my life. And when I was sitting down and explaining to her, like, these digital artists are selling artwork. And it really kind of opened up how I viewed a lot of the intent for an artist. And I think one of the founders from Nifty Gateway talked a little bit about this, where the intent or an artist's signature, for example, if they are intending for there to be one of one and it's on chain, you can prove that it is a one of one and it is coming from that artist originally, that signature originally, that is the fundamental piece that is important to buying a piece of artwork in the physical and digital world. Like knowing that the artist intended for you to have that is such a huge key part that kind of blurs the line between the two, physical and digital. So I like thinking about it around intent, and I do like thinking about it as the signature. Like you could have a signature on a painting and it's the same thing as having, that minted on chain under your address as the artist. And I think that there is going to be some bridges. Like for example, we were talking about this before with Beeple, and Beeple just made history yesterday as of recording this, selling a piece for $6 million. Which is just wild. Yeah. On Nifty Gateway's secondary market, they came out and said, like, we confirm this. The person wants to remain anonymous. I may or may not know who was involved around that, but I think it's a substantial mark in the space that says that this one piece of art could sell for $6 million. And there's just so much hype and things like that. But Beeple's intent was to have it be that one of one. He intended to get it in the hands of like bona fide art collectors and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's an important piece because Beeple's really spearheading the space. I've been following everything with his Everydays and things like that. His collection there with B20 tokens done by Metacoven and Metapurse that are really spearheading that. But yeah, art is a good one. I really like that because it helps artists and that's near and dear to me.
Yeah.
But I think gaming is pretty crystal clear, in my opinion, the play to earn concepts of ownership and owning pieces. But yeah, what are your thoughts around the physical and digital pieces of NFTs?
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge because it's so fundamentally different than I think what most people are taught as valuable as a kid would be, right? Like you get a physical item, like maybe your parents give you like a tiny little, like, you know, 1/8 ounce gold coin. They're like, this is valuable because it's, you know, it's lustrous. It's a physical piece of metal, what, you know, what have you. And so to change your way of thinking and be like, this $200, you know, bundle of bits and bytes basically is also a tangible, but semi untangible asset that I can't hold, but it's still valuable. I think that's a tough mental gymnastics thing for a lot of people to get around. Mm-hmm. But like you said, naturally for gamers, been doing this for a long time and actually in a far worse way, because, you know, if you play Fortnite, you're buying all these skins and, like, you know, items in the game that are A, not really attributable to you in terms of ownership. Like if your account gets burned, right? If it gets hacked and someone closes your account or you get banned from Fortnite, you don't carry those items with you. Like that money is just gone, right? Those items are gone. Whereas on the flip side with non-fungible tokens in a minimally viable ecosystem, you'll carry your earnings in games and across games probably for eternity, right? As you earn them or as you buy them. And I think ownership is just very, very important to the gaming industry. Like that's where it's been trending for a long time. But finally the technology is there to do it in a way that's not siloed to one game studio.
Now, don't forget to subscribe to Steve's channel if you have a chance. But if it weren't abundantly clear already, anyone arguing against digital collectibles and items are simply arguing against the future, like someone who said the telephone will never replace face-to-face communication. The shift towards true, verifiable digital ownership of video game items, art, the deed to your home, and more is well underway already, and the next generation of humans on this earth are already and will no doubt continue to be born into a world where this is a normalized behavior. That being said, to anyone resisting this or attempting to imply that tokenized assets are meritless, I bid you a respectful but firm 404, logic not found. Now, I did also want to shout out the ongoing Phantasma NFT art contest that is ongoing right now, for which I am a judge. Artists can submit their original works to be minted on Phantasma's Ghost Market NFT marketplace, and myself, along with a panel of judges, are going to pick winners to win a plethora of different prizes, including a first place prize of 10,000 Sol tokens, the native cryptocurrency on Phantasma. So I'll go ahead and link the announcement tweet with all the rules and information of the contest if you're interested, but I'm really stoked to see all the art that's flowing in that is Heshoshi themed or tangentially just crypto themed. It's really cool to see what folks are creating. Now, in regards to Polkadot, there was a piece of news that I thought was interesting, even though it may not be set in stone quite yet. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar, Polkadot is an interoperability-focused blockchain protocol that will enmesh multiple purpose-built blockchains together, which are called parachains, into a cohesive network. Now, soon, the projects that are building parachains will begin their auction process for parachain developers to lock in a slot for their own project in the larger Polkadot ecosystem. Now, this whole auction process has started to, you know, spark some debate as to whether this pay-to-play environment is unilaterally beneficial to the network. And of course, this again prompted suggestions that Polkadot will set aside a few slots in the network for community benefit parachains that are not tied to a particular project or token. This, of course, needs to be voted on by the community in Polkadot's governance process, but these community-focused parachains would sort of be like the community centers in your proverbial community online, and it would be used to facilitate operations like staking, governance, or even native Polkadot smart contract environments for dApp developers to test and build in. These would be neutral grounds for all Polkadot users, essentially. And whether this materializes or not is far from certain because it must be voted on, but it will be a cool thread to follow as time goes on and the precious parachain slots are locked in, because I have a feeling these auctions are going to go super quickly and it's going to require some significant resources to get a slot. Now, folks, if you've got some time to stick around, please do check out my latest VPN picks video where I outline my absolute favorite VPN services that will serve you well in 2021 if you're looking for a healthy layer of encryption on your browsing traffic. But as always, thanks so much for watching Crypto Over Coffee, and I hope you and your family have a great and restful weekend and week ahead. And until next time, cheers.